薄いのアホ。
プリズムタワーメイクアップカードレ
ディー。 Welcome to Shoujo and Tell, where we discuss shoujo manga and tell who's hot and who's not, talk about themes, and just generally geek out. Today, April 15th, 2018, we'll be shoujo and telling about the series Fushigi-Yugi by Yu Watase. I can't pronounce things, please forgive me. I'm now going to call it FY throughout the rest of this, hopefully. I'm your host, Ashley McDonald, and I'm joined by Caitlin Moore and Jess Tan. How you guys?
Hi, I'm Caitlin.
Hi, I'm Jess.
You may remember both of them because Caitlin was on the Millennium Snow episode, and Jess Tan was on the Cardcaptor Sakura episode. And now they're on this first episode with three people that we're having, so it might get a little more wild and wacky than usual. Caitlin has talked a lot about FY, so Caitlin, can you give a 1 to 2 minute little plot synopsis of what this series is about?
So Fushigi-Yugi is the story of Miyaka Yuki, an ordinary 15-year-old girl who is currently facing a lot of pressure from her family and her friends about exams, specifically about taking an exam for a school that is really high ranking when she's not very bright. One day she goes to the library and she stumbles onto a book in the forbidden section and opens it up, and it is called The Universe of the Four Gods, and she immediately goes into the book. And her best friend Yui, who is also taking the exams but is also super smart, reads the book for a while, telling of her travails as she is made the priestess of Suzaku, meets a really hot guy named Tamahome, meets a hot emperor named Hodohori, and she must go and gather the seven warriors of Suzaku to summon the god and have her wishes granted. So they go out to find the warriors, and they find Tosuke, they find... Oh, Yui also gets pulled into the book, and she is made the priestess of Seiryu, and goes from being Miyaka's best friend to Miyaka's bitter enemy. Various shenanigans happen. They find Tosuke, Chichiri, Chiriko, Noriko, and Mitsukake, not in that order.
Nope. I feel like it was the order of their importance, though, so.
No!
Oh,
no,
even Noriko would be much higher in that case.
Exactly.
Okay.
Spoiler alert, my favorite character.
But anyway, shenanigans continue to happen. And that's pretty much it, as far as we can go without major spoilers.
Yeah. Searching for celestial warriors to summon gods. So I wanted to establish what our familiarity with the series is, because I'm pretty sure we all saw this when we were far younger. I'm not sure if that's true for Caitlin. Is that true for you?
I was 12.
Okay, yes, and you were very young. Jessica and I were trying to establish when we both watched it, but Jessica watched, like, first got into the series much younger than me, right, Jessica?
Yeah, I was so young, my older sisters made me stop watching at a certain point, for yeah. obvious reasons.
That was probably, yeah, that was probably smart.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was 12 and in the VHS era, and my friend picked up a random volume at Suncoast and lent it to me because we were both sort of getting into anime at the same time. And my world kind of changed after that. But like, it actually took me a really long time to watch the whole series in order because VHS was expensive and the internet was not good at videos yet. So like, for years it was just sort of like bits and pieces. Wikipedia didn't exist, so like, it wasn't like it was that easy to just look up plot summaries. So yeah. I love Fushigi.
Yeah, I feel like we felt that pain too.
I don't know, I feel like I was able to experience the whole series basically in two goes, you know.
Really?
After the like few year hiatus that my sisters enforced. I think my sisters and I got into it because some older cousins of ours were watching it. And I guess that means I had access to the VHS the whole time. Does that sound familiar, Ash?
Interesting.
Like, did we watch it together on tape? Because for me, it was never an access issue. Because I remember, like, my sisters just locked me out of the room as they kept watching. So, like, we basically just were able to watch the whole series. Until it got too dark and deep, and my sisters were like, oh my gosh, you're way too young for this. Get out of the room while we continue watching.
I think I had to get into it later than you.
I think I refound it and shared it with you.
Yeah, that would make sense.
Yeah.
That, so we had to be like 12. Like Caitlin. See? 12 was a good age to watch this, apparently.
Yeah, I don't know.
Listen, I think it is.
Was it really? But there's so many situations and shenanigans that are maybe not appropriate for a 12-year-old.
You know what? You got to learn.
I don't know if I caught the nuances at that stage. I'm pretty sure I didn't, in fact.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, but then I guess when Genbu Kaiden came out, we went back again. And at that point, we were like at least 15.
Yeah. Actually, when did Genbu come out?
I don't know.
Seems like an important
tidbit. I didn't even read all of it because I didn't like her style change.
You're wrong. That's okay. I am ashamed to admit that I still have bootlegged DVDs of FY. And that's how I remember primarily watching it. Oh, I guess this gives context to when we had to watch it. It had to be middle school because I lent the OAVs to somebody and they never gave them back to me. And I definitely did that in 7th or 8th grade. So,
how dare.
Rude. How dare they? I know.
Those were precious commodities back then. My library had tapes.
Ooh.
I checked out a bunch of it. Yeah, I was able to see by checking it out of the library. But like library video rentals were only for like a couple of days at a time.
Oh, yeah. So you had to like binge watch, pre-Netflix binge watching. Yeah, and so for anybody who's unclear, like the anime is actually pretty faithful to the manga as far as I recall. Now I've read the manga far more recently than watching the anime. But from what I remember, it's pretty faithful.
Yeah.
So if you've only seen the anime, like this discussion is probably fine. Yeah, but like what made you all love this series back in the day / now, assuming you still love it now?
I do still love it now.
Okay, Caitlin, you start off.
You know, it was the late 90s and media for girls wasn't really very commonplace back then. And I think that is a major part of why I got into anime in general, because that was sort of the heyday of... That was when Fushigi Yugi and Magic Knight Rares and like shoujo manga was sort of starting to come out in the US. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it wasn't like anything I had seen before. And I say that with absolute confidence. I had never seen anything like it before that. And it was just sort of something that I never knew I needed, but I did. You know, a story about a teenage girl, you know, going on adventures and like being involved in this like kind of scary but also like really like intriguing story. And I didn't see any of the episodes that were like really rapey. Like I said, it took me a long time to like, but like just something about those first few episodes I saw, which were when Miyaka goes to rescue Yui from Seiryu from Kuto, that just sort of captured me. You know, and it was a long time ago. It was like 18 years ago. So I can't say what exactly it was, but I do remember just watching that video for the first time and sort of seeing it capture my imagination. I think part of it was also I had a friend at that time who now draws comics professionally, Corey Michelle. She was a friend of mine online at the time. And she would draw a fan art of Fushigi Yugi. So it was always like, this is what she's so into. But anyway, so yeah, like, it was my favorite anime for a long time. And then it sort of became a thing to hate on it. And I was like, oh, Fushigi Yugi, so like, so dumb and ridiculous and like overwrought. And then I rewatched it as part of the Anime Feminist podcast. And I was like, actually, no, I do love this series. I really, really do.
You're like, it is all those things, but I still love it.
It is. Exactly. It is.
Yeah.
It is.
Great. Jessica, do you agree? Have other feelings? You just love Noriko so much.
Noriko's very good.
Well, like I said, my sisters and I were first exposed because our older male cousins were watching it. And I think what first caught my attention was like the amazing opening.
Oh, yeah.
Like the music, the animation, it's so fabulous and fantastic and just like eye-catching and ear-catching, and like it still sticks in my mind. And as I was reading the manga, I kept hearing music and I was like, oh my god, all the feels. So I think for me it was actually the opening that first hooked me, because you see so many amazing things, and like I can still see like the awesome flashing lights and the like martial arts and the pretty clothes, the pretty people. I think when I first saw it at age probably 9, I wasn't that into hot guys, but maybe I was.
Maybe. So
that might have caught my attention too. But actually, what Caitlin said is kind of opposite of what I felt, I think, when I first watched it. Because I did grow up watching some girl-centric things, and some of the aspects of the FY universe are kind of built off of Chinese mythology or Chinese history. So some of those elements were actually kind of similar to other magical or historical shows that I had watched growing up. So like some Chinese cartoons also use like phoenixes and dragons, and the ideas of priestesses and things like that weren't too unfamiliar to me. But I think what I really, really loved about it was that it was about a young girl who, yeah, she's ordinary, but she's also like ridiculous, right? She's so, she's just like laughable a lot of the time. And at the same time, you can really connect with her because she's struggling so much through life. And like, she has trouble with her mom, and what teenage girl doesn't? And she has trouble with her best friend. And Ashley and I were actually talking about how we, our relationship kind of could have been sort of similar to the relationship with Miyaka and Yui, although apparently both of us thought we were Miyaka in the duo.
Listen, you're Yui, don't lie to me.
No, I'm the tipsy glutton, right? Come on, you can't argue with
that. I can't argue with that aspect.
Exactly. So I think everyone, every girl maybe, I don't know, can connect with at least one of the pair of them, if not both. And like their loyalty to each other, even though, spoiler alert, it breaks apart, like it's just really moving and touching. And the relationship that Miyaka developed with her celestial warriors is also really touching. And I've always been like, relationships, like people getting to love each other, yay, like that's what draws me into stories and keeps me invested. And I think FY does that beyond any other anime or manga I had been exposed to for at least like the first half of my life. Maybe yeah. I found more things now, but back then it was definitely the thing that really showed me human relationships in a way that just kept me watching even through all the like angst and drama and tears and death, including my favorite character.
Oh, spoilers, Jasmine.
Spoiler.
It's hard to talk about FY without spoilers. True. I feel like I had an experience closer to Caitlin, probably, where I was like, I don't watch girly things. Girls suck. I hate girls. It's probably why Toski's my favorite character. That's not why he's my favorite character. I was also a tomboy. I hope that Toski's not my favorite character because he says that he hates women. So then, like, there was some point in my life around when this was happening, and like Escaflowne and like getting into Nicholas Sparks novels, where I was like, you know, I have feelings, and I should, like, embrace them. Like, feelings don't have to be bad. Yeah, so I think FY for me is also still a little peculiar in that normally I really, really ship the main ship that it wants you to, like, really, really hard. But, like, Miyaka and Tamahome, I'm like, yeah, okay. Like, they're fine. But I'm actually much more invested in the other Celestial Warriors, which is kind of strange for me, but I like it. It's nice. Yeah, so before we go into real spoilers, where we can say all the people who have died and whatever else.
In the first half of the series, oh my god.
I know, I was kind of like, oh, Volume 9, just a random stopping point because it's midway. I was like, ooh, is everybody going to live through that? Nope, nope. Okay.
Nope. No, I mean, to be fair, like, it's more than halfway through the main arc. And the second arc was mostly just written because the editors were like, and I mean, Yuutase literally says this, the editors were like, write more Fushigi Yugi. And she's like, okay, I guess.
Yeah,
because it's doing so well. You just gotta go on. Yeah. before we go further, I wanted to clarify that you can, if you haven't read FY or you have, but you don't have a copy of it or whatever, it is available digitally and physically in North America from Viz Media, as are many of many other Yuwatase works, including more FY with Genbu Kaiden, but also like Serez, Absolute Boyfriend, those things, many series that she's written. And, if you're more into anime, the anime is available on Crunchyroll. And spoilers, my romantic partner Jeff works at Viz on their mobile apps, and I did not read the manga through his app. I read it on Kobo, so oops, lol. Yes, so now we're going to be spoilers, and just so I will give the very quick, like, where Volume 9 stops so that people know exactly what we're talking about. But yeah, like, Volumes 1 through 6/7 are Miyaka finding all of her celestial warriors, but failing to do so because Amiboshi has pretended to be Chiriko and messed up their summoning ceremony. So that leads to the second arc, where it's like now they all have to go on another journey to find another way to summon the gods. And 7 through 9 is both of them traveling to like go find Genbu and Byakko's like treasure things that they've left behind to do that. And so, as established, Amiboshi, Ashitara, who's another Seiryu warrior, and Noriko die. Those are the main deaths. That's all. Those are the only main deaths that have happened.
Tamahome's family.
Oh, Tamahome's family. Yeah, they die too.
That's pretty heartbreaking too. I was sobbing.
Yeah, Jessica apparently was like crying a lot.
Okay, so like when I watched it most recently, a lot of the stuff in the anime, at least, was Tamahome's family was really emotionally manipulative.
Wait, what?
They come in and, like, Yui Ren's just barely alive. She's, like, giving a dying speech.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. The dying speech is kind of cheesy.
Actually, don't remember this at all.
Well, come on. His little sister is like, welcome home.
Oh, yeah, that.
I just, like, I really don't like, overly cutesy kids in fiction. Like, I really, really don't. Because I work with kids and they're not like just, they're cute, but they're not just like, welcome home, big brother.
I don't know. I'm just not a fan of the trope of like, I gave a dying speech perfectly with my last breath trope. I'm like, no, come on, you're in pain and it sucks.
Yeah. But there's a lot of power and emotion in that entire scene.
It was there. So yeah, like that part was just like, whatever. But like, for me, when he found Chue with a knife was what set me off. And then when he's at the grave by himself and he's like, just wants to be alone.
Yeah.
Those were the parts that got me.
Mm-hmm. Jessica's like, I was crying too much.
I was crying throughout. I mean, I haven't revisited the series in a very long time, and it actually, I think it's better for me that way, but at the same time, I like still remember enough that I was emotionally distraught leading up to the emotionally
yeah, you're like, I know
situation.
It's gonna happen.
I know it's coming. I know I'm gonna start crying probably. I think I cry more now, a lot more now than I did when I was, you know, in middle school. I don't remember sobbing this much, but hey, maybe it's selective memory.
No, I feel like that checks out for me. That's something I would do. But yeah, then Volume 9 ends where I guess we're entering, like, rapey arc, where Nakugo seems to have raped Miyaka, and she's very distressed about that. And then literally the end of Volume 9 is Yui says something to Tsuboshi that makes him be like, oh, the priestess of Suzaku bothers you. I'm gonna go, like, kill her. So then he appears before Miyaka and is, like, threatening to kill her. And then it just ends.
And of course
what a
she's
great
by herself.
Yeah, she's by herself because she ran away from Tamahome.
Yep, as usual.
I don't know why they don't... They're all just so trusting with no basis for that.
Trusting? Like they haven't, what do you mean?
Like, they're all like, you won't leave me, right? And then
person
will
be
like,
no, they're not trusting
yes.
at all.
But
they're all
still
paranoid. They're all paranoid about it because they trained each other already to keep ditching each other after promising to stay.
Yeah, but they're so bad
at
preventing it.
Like, that's a recurring theme. Huh?
They're so bad at preventing it.
they're bad at preventing it, but that doesn't mean they're trustful, because they're always clutching at each other and like, promise me, promise me.
Miyaka and Yui have a very codependent, not Miyaka and Yui, Miyaka and Tamahome. I'm still looking up a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, that's a different couple. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a whole other thing.
Yeah.
That is a whole other thing.
But Miyaka and Tamahome definitely have this kind of like very codependent relationship.
Yeah. And also reading it this time, I was shocked at how insta-lovey they were.
I know, right?
And I was actually like, wait, maybe this is why I can't be so invested in the relationship, because initially, like, what is their relationship? She just finds a hot guy saving her life and like becomes so in love with him that she's willing to abandon her world for him.
Yeah, like I'd buy you know, they're teenagers, they're hormonal, like I can imagine things happening like really fast at first, but the sort of putting it up as like, oh, it's the truest and greatest love, you know, that's like,
yeah.
And I think a lot of that is editorial interference, because just like, you know, there's a lot of really interesting revealing information in the sidebars, because Yuatase is a lot more outspoken than I think a lot of other manga writers.
Yeah, that is what immediately hit me reading those sidebars. I was like, wow, Yuatase, you're just like coming at it, damn, all right.
Yeah, it's like stream of consciousness, woof.
And I love it. I love how she's just like
honest.
She's just like totally honest in it, because most manga writers will not be like, they're much more restrained in talking about the frustrations that they have to deal with. But yeah, so like she's like, I wanted them to be separated at the end. Like, I'm not really into writing romance. So yeah, I think a lot of like what ended up happening was editorial interference.
Yeah, I'm just surprised she's allowed to be that forthright. Like, they publish her forthrightness.
Right?
Like, that's what confuses me. And I thought it was really ironic when, yeah, she writes, like, she's like, everybody thought I would end up writing shonen manga and, like, writing for Shonen Sunday. And then I think of her writing Errata the Legend and how badly that has turned out for her. Like, so much editorial interference and, like, health problems. And, like, I think she's basically dropped that series at this point. After like 20-something volumes, because now she's writing more FY. She's writing Byakko arc.
Mm.
But yeah, it's just like, Yuatase is very forthcoming about like her health problems, editors being annoying, and it's great, and I love it. Still don't know how it's published. But yeah, stepping back a little, since I feel that, you know, FY is definitely a series that garners intense feelings, because there are so many people to have intense feelings about. Just establish who everybody's favorite celestial warrior is and why. We'll start with Jessica, since we already know it's Noriko. Why do you love Noriko?
Oh, what is not to love? I mean, I guess the fact that I don't even know which pronoun to use right now, because Noriko is Noriko.
They use she at the end.
Oh, I know, but there are moments when...
We ended up going with they for the AniFem podcast. Okay.
But I don't think that's quite right either, because Noriko is sometimes a she and sometimes a he.
Like, the thing is... they is generally a safe choice. And the thing is that, you know, it was the 90s, and I'm not saying this to excuse it, but, like, people were ignorant about transness back then, and even the difference between or gender fluidity, or even sort of the difference between gender identity and sexual orientation.
Yeah,
so like there's no good way to talk about Noriko and pronouns. It's a lose battle.
I think I might just switch between he and she depending on which part of the personality I want to focus on at the moment. So I'll start with like his relationship with his younger sister, and how at a very young age, when he lost her due to an accident, he decided to keep her with him by becoming her, since they had always looked very similar, and how he basically became her and lived a life as a woman and identified so much as a woman that as Noriko fell in love with the hot Emperor Hotohori. And then, you know, the relationships that were developed among the characters, they're just so powerful. And Noriko's at the center of so many of them. and acts as like an older brother to Tamahome sometimes, an older sister to Miyaka sometimes, an older someone providing guidance, but at the same time always being the optimistic, laughing, like beating people up to cheer them up or beating people up to put some sense into them. I just really appreciated all the interactions that Noriko has with all the other characters. And I think that his death was really powerful, and maybe that cemented my love for him. But even before that, I was totally on, like, I never really liked Tamahome, but I really, 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 really fell in love with the character of Noriko and just could not stand that he dies.
At what point did you decide that you liked Noriko? Because in the beginning, Noriko is a little hard to take.
This I need to think about.
Because, like, I knew that Noriko was your favorite. And reading it, I was just like, oh my god, Noriko's terrible.
I think I first start changing my mind or start realizing the worthiness of Noriko during the mirror scene.
Yeah.
Because she's the first one to run away. Right? Like, she's been exposed as actually a man mm-hmm. by evil Mirror Miyaka and immediately runs away and, like, God, is destroying
trees. I'm so sorry. It's just so impossible to talk about Noriko's gender without me just, like, cringing into infinity. Like...
Yeah. It's hard to read when Miyaka says stuff like, but aren't you a homo? And I'm like, that's not the same thing. Ding, Miyaka!
Yeah. That also threw me, and I sort of excused it-ish as, like, not excused it, but I was, like, trying to remember that, again, this was written in the 90s, and mm-hmm. the concepts that we might be cringing over might not have been, like, considered or known the way they are now. So trying to, like, distance myself a little and cringing, but also trying to be, like,
I mean, certainly in the 90s, I wasn't woke. I didn't know.
I didn't. I thought all those gay jokes were hilarious.
I don't remember understanding them personally at the age of like 9 or whatever when I first was exposed. But yeah, definitely in middle school, I had some awareness at that point. But I don't think I reacted as strongly as I do now.
Yeah.
Reading those jokes. But right. So just that scene where he comes back, or she comes back, or they come back and rescues the other three and takes care of them while they're all killing themselves to save the others. That is when I think I realized that Noriko is like the rock that holds them together and isn't an idiot, you know? Like, the other three are literally just dying because they're trying to save each other. And only one person is, like, not seriously injured, and I really respected the role that Noriko fulfills in that moment, like taking control, becoming serious, and having turned back after a very, very painful moment of exposure in front of the person he loved, or she loves.
They love. I do like at the end, I think that when Noriko dies, Miyaka is very respectful in that she's like, gender has nothing to do with it. Noriko mm-hmm. is just Noriko. And I was like, at mm-hmm. least you had that in there. That's nice.
Yeah.
It's, like, listen, we get into Noriko's gender a little bit on the Chatty AF podcast.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Yeah, well, because we have Vry, and Vry is non-binary, so it's, yeah, but that's not what we're here for.
Wait, really quickly, I also really like Amaboshi.
Like Amaboshi?
Yeah.
Okay.
We can get into that during the second.
Great. So, Caitlin, I feel that I actually do not know yet who your favorite Celestial Warrior is.
It's Noriko.
It's also Noriko?
It's also Noriko.
Do you have a different take on why you love Noriko?
You know, it's pretty close. Noriko is just this constant presence of, like, I mean, yeah, at first they were like, you know, bitches gotta be competing over guys. Yeah. You know, but even then, like, at that time, like, when they were like, why are you picking on Miyaka? And Noriko is just like, I don't get what the deep big deal is over this child. Like, so it's like, it's petty, ugly jealousy, but I also, like, kind of get it, because, like, yeah, like, what is the big deal about Miyaka? Mm-hmm. Like, and I say that I like Miyaka. Like, but everyone's falling over themselves for this, like, not very bright, you know, everyone's falling over themselves for this girl, and because, like, no one cares about me, and it sucks. So, like, you know, I get it. But then, like, once they sort of, like, stop sort of thinking about Miyaka as a rival and more as a friend, there's just this constant just pillar of support and love within their within the group. They for the first few arcs until they get Mizukage, they're the only one who acts like a goddamn adult. Everyone else is just a complete idiot all the time.
And Chichiri has his moments.
I mean, but they're someone that I would want to have in my life.
Mm-hmm.
That's fair. I would agree. I like Noriko. They're just not my favorite. And I have to say that when Mizukage came into the story and, like, was shown to be a celestial warrior, I was like, I don't remember this dude at all. Oh my god, holy crap. Sorry, Mizukage. That's how little you made an impression on me.
That's pretty sad.
It's pretty sad.
Unfortunate. Poor Mizukage.
Like, he's a good dude. He's a healer. Like, I'm about him, but, like...
I wish that we had gotten to spend more time getting to know Mizukage, because he's honestly, like, the few times that we get a joke out of him, like, he's got this, like, really, like, dry sense of humor.
Yeah.
That I wish we had really gotten a chance to see more of.
Yeah. I guess he's not hot enough or something. I don't know.
Well, he's also taken.
Oh, yeah.
Right? So maybe that's part of it.
Yeah, kind of.
Like, I think Chichiri, too, like, is also taken, basically. Right?
Yeah, but
like,
Chichiri is cool.
Yeah.
I remember Chichiri. I mean,
well, yeah. But there's no angst in terms of, like, their romantic entanglements, which is a lot of what we have to focus on based off of what we're given to focus on, right?
Yeah.
Like, Mizukage, his moment is when he has to kill the woman he loves, or basically the demon that possesses the woman he loves.
And then there's, like, no moments after that.
Yeah,
he's got
that's
a
really...
cat. His cat has more moments.
Cat. His cat definitely has more moments than he does.
Poor Mizukage. I guess I'm going to be a dissenting opinion here and just say that Toski is my favorite celestial warrior.
So you haven't changed your mind?
Toski is top tier.
Yeah, see, Toski's cool. I will admit that he basically checks all my, like, type boxes, I guess. Like, yeah. I have a very specific type. He's like, armchair, check. Fiery, check. Wolves, check. All right, Toski, we're best friends.
You like the fangs.
Fangs, check. but also, he is just genuinely a, like, you know, he's very honest, forthright, try hard, a little silly. I'm like, yeah, man, that's the personality I like. Just be real honest and try hard. I love it. And he's a good dude. Can't swim, some good gags.
He's very funny.
Chichiri is a close second.
Chichiri is also very good. Like, these are all top tier warriors.
Except Mizukage. No, none of us like the hot temper. That's kind of
funny. He was my favorite for a long time, and then when I rewatched it, I realized he sucks.
Tell us more.
He's just constantly violating Miyaka's boundaries. He's a bad emperor because he, like, just gets up and disappears while his country is in the middle of tensions with another country. And there's some stuff in the second half that I will talk about why what he did suck. But he's just, like, hitting on Miyaka constantly, even though he knows she's not interested. Like, one of the first nights, he's like, you're going to be coming and sleeping in my room. And she's like, I'm not comfortable with this, but I can't say no because he's the emperor. The moment that Tamahome is gone, he's like, oh, forget about him and date me. And then he, like,
not date, marry.
Yeah, marry me.
Marry, even more intense.
they don't do dating. And
fair.
Yeah, there's no dating. It's just like and marriage like, or nothing.
And when he says he loves Miyaka, he doesn't. He loves the idea of her. He loves the idea of the priestess of Suzaku.
I think he also loves the idea of not being alone for the first time ever.
Right. Yeah, like absolutely. So he's his whole life, without knowing anything about who this person would be, he's like, I'm going to love the priestess of Suzaku. She is the girl who is meant for me. She is the girl who is destined for me. And the moment Miyaka arrives, without knowing anything about her, he's like, this is it. This is the priestess of Suzaku. I love her.
Yeah.
I have a little bit of that for Tom Home too, though. Like, he uses his character, like, his role as a celestial warrior as part of the reason that they're destined.
I mean, it's a little bit different.
I'm not disagreeing with you at all. I'm just saying that, like, I have problems with Miyaka and Tamahome's relationship as well, the same line.
Tamahome isn't so much like, I have this character, so I was destined to fall in love with you. His is more like, I have this character, so like our destinies are intertwined. I was destined to protect you, and like love just happens to be part of the equation for him, is I think the thing. Like, because when she like tries to run off, it's not like he doesn't love me, it's like I don't want to put him in danger. Well, there are times where it's like, oh, Tom Holme doesn't love me, but you know, with him with him it does tend to be more, I think, more about like, I'm not going to abandon you.
Yeah.
Because our destinies are intertwined, and not like, I've been obsessed with you since I was a little child because you are the priestess of Suzaku. And it's more about like who he is and the idea of his role rather than who she is and who he wants her to be.
I think there's a bit of both, though, even for him, because yes, like, he doesn't instantly fall in love with her or think he's fallen in love with her because she happens to be a girl from another world who can become the priestess of Suzaku. But he also doesn't really know her. He also doesn't really, I don't know, like...
Yeah, and, like, I think the romance in general, like, you know, it's pretty... I have complicated feelings about pretty much everything about Fushigi Yugi. Because I think the way it's handled and, like, they fell in love, and a lot of their reasons for being together are like very like, and this is very standard, I think, for a fantasy shoujo. Like, they're very flimsy. I think he is a really good boyfriend to her. They are very clingy, but he's also like very, very sweet to her. And like, when she's like, I've been sullied, I can't summon Suzaku, I don't deserve to be with you, he doesn't get mad. Like, she was not asking for it, but she went looking for trouble. More or less, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, he doesn't get mad at her for putting herself in that situation.
Yeah, he's just like, I look at you and you're still the same Miyaka, like, you know, don't feel so bad, I still love you. And then she runs away because Miyaka.
Yeah.
Yep. Yep. I mean, I definitely believe in his love for her. And I definitely believe that he's awesome for her. And the whole consent thing, though, like, he also pushes past her boundaries beyond where I'm comfortable with.
Yeah,
like, as the reader that I currently am.
Definitely, so, definitely. Like,
when you were just describing Hotori's advances, it actually reminded me a lot of Tamahome's as well. So both of them encroach and are too pushy with Miyaka.
Yeah.
And she says no, and neither of them back off.
Yep.
And she's, like, naked in half of these scenes, or, like, in her pajamas, which are, you know, very revealing, and she's 15.
Yeah,
and in their universe she's basically a full-grown woman, because at age 15 in ancient China, which is what their world resembles, age 15 you're already like married and having children, I'm sure. But neither of them respect her boundaries ever. Yeah. Basically,
I agree. Like, I definitely do think that, yeah, there are definitely times when Tamahome pushes past her boundaries really badly.
And she ends up okay with it, but that's still not okay with me, you know?
I 100% agree. And Fushigi Yugi is way too permissive towards that sort of behavior. But, like, I think overall, the good outweighs the bad with Tamahome. Yeah. But I don't think Hotohori ever really fully redeems himself.
Oh, another reason I love Noriko so much. When he falls in love with Miyaka, he doesn't even tell her.
Yeah, that's true.
Oh, like, he just wants her happy.
Yeah.
And that's another reason why I'm such a fan.
Yeah.
Yeah, Noriko even tells Tamahome to be like, don't make this easy for me, Tamahome. Nice try. Miyaka loves you.
Yeah, you two be together while yeah. I go with my life. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Even, like, watching it recently, Noriko's death scene was ugly sobbing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not, like, not like, oh, I'm a little teary, but, like, lying down on the couch and crying.
Oh, no.
Right.
Yeah, I was in bed crying with my tissue box like within reach because I knew his home tag.
So I assume that's the most affecting scene for both of you. Noriko dying.
Yeah.
I have to admit that I didn't cry because I still struggle with my garbage. I don't have feelings.
Oh.
Roboticness, oh. I guess. But actually, the moment that I remember really sticking out to me is not Noriko's death. I'm very sorry. It was actually nobody's death.
That's absolutely fine. No need to apologize.
I am so sorry that I have all the wrong feelings.
How dare you?
No, no. Your feelings are your feelings.
How dare I have
your
wrong
feelings are valid, Ashley. Stop apologizing for them.
That's
keep going.
Okay, I do like the one thing that Hotohori says. I don't know that he ever actually embraces it. Is that he's like, what Miyaka taught me is that you can't control other people's feelings. I'm like, yes.
Mm-hmm.
In general, you can't even control your own feelings sometimes. Feelings are hard to control.
But Miyaka said that first.
Yeah.
He just got that from Miyaka.
He just got that from Miyaka, and he doesn't believe it in his heart, I think, is the problem.
I think, well, the thing is, he sort of is respectful. Like, sort of. This is very hand-waving. Very, like, me trying to see the good in him. And it is a little bit of a, it is a bit of a push, but like he does sort of, I think in his own way, respect Miyaka's feelings for Tamahome. Like again, trying to remember that he's an emperor. He's what, 17 or 19? I forget.
He's actually 18.
18?
Don't quote me.
Sorry. Well, 17, 19, average 18.
Yeah,
I was in the right ballpark. The point I was trying to make is that he has never really had a romantic relationship with anyone. And even though he was originally in love with the idea of her, he did, like, what he talked about when he described the feelings for her later are about her warmth and about her personality. So even though I, like, have a huge problem with all of them falling in love with her and the way they fall in love with her practically, like Tamahome and Hotohori, they do develop real feelings. And Hotohori, his feelings become, I think, real for her, and he does in his own way try to respect the fact that she loves Tamahome. And like
he tries
his trying to push her to forget him, I think was his way of trying to help her pass something he saw as an insurmountable like end to their relationship. I don't think it was selfish. I think it was actually him trying to help her and saying, even though you've lost him, I'm still here. Caitlin is not sold.
Caitlin is not amused by
this.
I'm not convinced.
All right. Hotohori is a controversial emperor person.
Like, and I mean, I'm just coming from the angle where, like, I was super into Hotohori when I was, like, 12, 13, 14 years old.
And
I wrote
glorious hair. Come on.
Oh, it is glorious hair. Oh, yeah. In the anime when he takes off his crown and it all just comes cascading down.
The sparkle?
It is glorious.
It is glorious.
But, like, I wrote, like, self-insert fan fiction with Hotohori.
Aww.
Like, I loved him. And then I rewatched it as an adult and, like, a lot of Fushigi Yugi, like, I don't want to say it holds up, but my perception of the series is very different, and I found a lot of different strengths in it. But, like, Hotohori is just, like, does not. He himself has not held up.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe I'm coming from it a little bit from the angle of, like, I used to love this guy, and now I think he's, and now, like,
falling
as an adult, I see his flaws, and so now I think he's, crappy dude.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think since you had him on a pedestal, he probably had a lot farther to fall in your perspective. But yeah. Even when I was 9, I was not fully on board with any of them initially. Like, Miyako was annoying to me, and Tamahome and Hotofori were annoying to me. Noriko was annoying to me initially, but I was most converted by Noriko, and I think that still holds up. But I was never fully on board with Miyako, Hotofori, or Tamahome. Like, I still, as an adult and as a child, like, I've never fully been on board, which is, I think, perfectly okay, because that means they're more human-like than many other manga characters. They're flawed. They're not supposed to be absolutely endearing cartoon characters. So I'm okay with the fact that I really find Miyako annoying a lot of the time. Mm-hmm. I'm okay with the fact that I find Hotofori, like, an overbearing, arrogant, narcissistic, gorgeous, and knows he's gorgeous man who also happens to be emperor. And I think what you said earlier about him stepping away from his emperor duties was, like, kind of dereliction of his duties. But at that time, when he stepped away, the one time he stepped away in the first half, the tension was there, but it wasn't, like, the threat was not that high at that moment. And he did have a substitute that everyone thought was him. And the second time everyone departs, I know, I love that. I love that name too. The second time everyone else departs, he remains. So I think that he is, from what I can tell, a good emperor. And he gives her a sword in his place. Like, that must have broken his heart, but he chose to be the emperor instead of being the celestial warrior at that moment. So far, during the first half, I think he really is the best that he can be, considering that he is a very flawed character.
Very flawed man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This manga needed more Miyako using Hotori's sword to fight people.
Yes!
I know!
That was such a good moment!
I know!
Yeah.
Damn it.
That definitely needs to happen more. Except, obviously, this was written 20 years ago, so...
Yeah, it's not going to. But yeah, so I will actually say my most emotionally affecting scene was very small in the scheme of things. I guess it was when Tamahome was captured, and they're fighting, and Totsuki is using... They're, like, meeting Totsuki, I guess. And he's using the cards that, like, he writes stuff on, and it makes wolves.
Oh, yes, I know.
But Miyako... Yeah, Miyako wrote Tamahome, and he came out, and then I was like, oh, that's so sad. Yeah. That hurt my little heart.
Yeah, because what else did she write? Cake? Noodles?
Cake. Like, yeah, cake
that
noodles.
Was,
everything
yeah,
else was food and absolutely useless. And the moment he appears, he actually kicks everyone's butt and saves them.
Yeah.
And then he disappears.
And then he disappears. Oh. And I was like, oh, no! What a clever use. I mean, it doesn't make any sense because how does the paper know what Tamahome looks like? But I guess Miyako thought magic. It while she wrote it, and then magic. I don't know.
How does the paper know what cake looks like? That's from an entirely different universe.
I don't know.
Or wolves. Wolves. Hello. Those wolves are paper too, and they can still bite.
I know.
So Tamahome can kick, you know.
I'm just, this paper mechanic just seems, I have questions.
That's the question you have, not how two girls are drawn into a book?
No, yeah, no.
That was
I accept
translated.
That as reality. No, my real question, I do have a real question, is why are the Seryu warriors evil? Am I reading this wrong? Like, none of the other ones are evil.
Because... flawed storytelling.
I mean, is that really the only answer? Because I'm like, that has to be the answer, right?
I don't think there's a good in-universe reason. Mm-hmm. I think that it speaks a lot to the sort of the setup of adolescence and Miyaka and Yui's experience of Miyaka sort of experiences a lot of the positive elements. So, all right. So my whole thing is that Fushigi Yugi... Okay, so we're really getting into it, because this is a theory that I've been working with for several months now. Fushigi Yugi is set up as a sort of a metaphorical coming-of-age story that takes the anxieties that Miyaka and Yui are both experiencing in their lives and sort of looks at, like, the positive elements and the negative elements, like, you know, these are all very typical anxieties for 15-year-old girls, but, like, power and prestige, sort of looking at getting into this high school, like, this really high-ranking high school, boys and love and sex, rivalry, competition, all of that sort of stuff. So Miyaka sort of gets to experience the positive sides of it. You know, she has a boyfriend who loves her. She has friends who care for her. You know, and I mean, she goes through trials, but she has this very supportive environment that she has throughout. Yui, on the other hand, sort of experiences the dark side of it. You know, she thinks she's in love, but she's really being manipulated. So I think there's not really a good in-universe reason, but if you look at it sort of as a on a meta level, that's sort of why. And also, Yuatase was really young when she wrote it. Like, it's not like there's, I think she, you know, she was 22 years old. It was her second major running series. Like, I think it's an incredible accomplishment for a 22-year-old, but there's going to be a lot. And plus, it was, you know, serial fiction. Like, there's going to be issues that you don't get with stuff that you can go back and edit and rewrite and rework to make sure everything fits together neatly. So I think, you know, there was sort of the combination between Watase being very, very young and sort of the meta level and the structural issues sort of leads to stuff like everyone in the Seiryu 7 is like bad and evil and that sort of, I think that's sort of what happened.
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense in the way that she constructed the story to be that way. Like, there are very explicit references.
I was just going to say, I think she does try to put in-universe explanations for why the Seiryu 7 are the way they are, except for Wolf Boy, who I can't even attempt to pronounce his name, and I don't think he deserves me trying because he killed my favorite character, but anyway. okay. Other than him, like the other seven, from what I can remember, we haven't met all seven in the first half, so, but like, of the ones we've met, except for Wolf Boy, they all could sort of path as normal, except for maybe Tomo. We actually never see his face in the first half.
I'm assuming that who we see in the shell when he has Miyaka captive is what he looks like normally. So, yeah.
Actually looks like? Okay, fine. So if that's what he looks like, then they all actually could pass as normal, right? But we're told from a very, like, even historically, 200 years ago, the Genbu warriors and or the people of Genbu talk about how the country, I forget what the country is, Chuzo or something? Kuto. So my point is that they're in an environment that is not, that has not allowed them to be normal and to be, like, we don't get their backstories yet, but when the second half happens and we get some of that backstory, I think the first half sets up enough of, like, this country is just a bad place to be and the emperor is just, like, this greasy,
awful
piece of poop. Like, he's just sewage, right? Like, I think that Watase sets up, even 200 years ago, that country was not a good place to be, right? So I think that that explains a lot of why the Seiryu 7 are the way they are. Like, they're not inherently evil. Like, even Wolf Boy, he was in a freak show, and if he had been found by someone who was as twisted and corrupted,
poor Ashitare.
Like, already, like, I think if someone else had found him and shown him goodness, he would not have been the monster that he was. And I think the same can go for any of the Seiryu 7. Like, if they had met the right people. And I think that's why I love Amiboshi. Spoiler alert, second half, like, there's more story for him. And I think that that's why I love him so much, because you can see how the environment and the influences of the people around you and the relationships you form with good people can really, really change your life and change who you are and change who you become. And I think that none of the other seven ever encounter that kind of influence. Like, there's no healthy people in that country because it's, like, just corrupt and awful. And the Suzaku seven all live very normal seeming lives. I mean, one's an emperor, so his life is, like, as normal as an emperor's can be. But other than that, like, being the Celestial Warrior was not a huge part of their, like, it, they weren't made to be freaks, right, by their powers. So they could pass off as normal.
Yeah.
And they were in a better country. They were in a peaceful country where there was not so much tension and corruption and abuse.
I mean, I think that's a little bit, I think it is kind of careful ground to tread saying that, like, people in a war-torn country are more likely to turn evil.
That's not quite what I'm saying. Rather that they meet the wrong people.
Right.
Like, the Emperor obviously has a lot of influence on Nakago, and he, in turn, influences all of the other seven. And his influence is very, very, very problematic.
Nakago sucks.
Yeah, like, he is very problematic.
He just sucks.
I mean, but his backstory when we get there is
but that's not an excuse.
I'm not saying it's an excuse, I'm saying that, like,
it's too little too late.
There are really bad people out there, but there are also really bad experiences that normal people have that then can impact who they become.
Yeah, I just, like, I'm very, like, I've just sort of gotten past, like, I don't excuse. Like, it's like that Brooklyn Nine-Nine gif. Like, cool motive, still murder.
Yeah, I'm not trying to excuse any of their behaviors. Like, I'm not saying it's okay to manipulate and kill.
Excuse was the wrong word. You know, it's anyway.
Like, I'm simply trying to argue that they're not inherently evil, but for the purpose of storytelling,
right?
There did have to be an enemy.
Yeah.
And I think, young as she was, she actually made them, again, there's, like, a lot in the second half that influences what I'm saying now, but I think Watase really did a good job of making people who have very bad actions, but giving, like, a reason for it. I'm not saying it excuses it. I'm not saying it's a good reason. I'm just saying it exists. It's not just, like, I need monsters. Let me put monsters in here so that our good people have something to conquer.
There's a lot more. Like, I guess, like, what attracts me to anime is, like, the problem that I have with most superhero movies and, like, dumb American stuff is that, like, there does seem to be the existence of, like, people are just evil because sometimes people are evil and they were born that way and they're just, like, inherently evil. And I'm like, no, that's dumb. So I do like that anime. It's the thing that I liked in Escaflowne. It's probably a thing I liked in this, even though we haven't gotten to the second half yet. And I haven't read or watched it in however many years, so I don't really remember.
You're remembering
that, like, it's like, having humanized evil characters is, like, appealing. I guess I just find it weird in FY because, especially now that we live in an age where, you know, there's Genbu, Kaiden, and Byakko Senki, that it's, like, in those other iterations, like, the warriors are never shown as evil. Like, only Seryu warriors are weirdly evil. And it makes sense from what Caitlin was saying before from a metaphorical standpoint of, like, well, this is the only one where they were, like, battling each other, and, like, clearly Miyaka's set up to be, you know, you're supposed to, like, sympathize with Yui and whatever, not think that she's evil. They say that over and over and over again, but clearly Miyaka's the main character. You're supposed to root for Miyaka to summon Suzaku, so it's, like, from a story necessitation level and metaphorical level, it makes sense. It's just weird given the rest of the universe that it's like, why is this one evil?
Yeah,
like, I feel like
we're all sort of looking at it from different angles, and that, you know, like, actually, like, I think that's really cool, is that, like, looking at it from different angles sort of brings different points of discussion into it.
Yeah, because I definitely look at it from the angle of just, like, it's weird that, like, you know, you give story reasons for why these people are this way, but, like, why?
Yeah,
why?
No, absolutely. And I don't think that, like, she had that in mind when she wrote it.
Yeah, right? It was very interesting seeing the original Genbu again in this, being like, okay, this was the seed of the one I like better.
I actually never read Genbu Kaiden all the way through.
It's good. It's very good.
I think that the drastic change in her drawing style made it hard.
I don't
for
think
me.
It was that drastic. And I think, yeah, Genbu Kaiden is interesting. It's definitely a much more polished story, but I kind of like the rawness of Fushigi-Yugi better.
Yeah, I mean, the rawness is, like, what gets you invested, kind of. You're like, I have so many intense feelings about this. Like,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And it could that could be 90% nostalgia goggles.
Yeah.
I really don't think so, though, because I think my nostalgia goggles exist, for sure. Like, I won't deny that. But I think there is really a lot of good stuff happening in this.
Yeah, no, I think so too. I mean, I think part of the reason I like the original Fushigi Yugi better than Genbu Kaiden is Nostalgia Goggles. I don't think I just like Fushigi Yugi because of Nostalgia Goggles.
I'll try Gemma Gaiden at some point and see how it holds up.
It's a much more polished story. Takiko?
Yeah, Takiko.
Yeah, Takiko. She's definitely closer to the kind of protagonist I generally like. But yeah, no, Fushigi Yugi is just her, like, I think it is a flawed but compelling story. And I think that it is has a lot more emotional power behind it.
Yeah, I think the rivalry part between two friends makes it more emotionally impactful than, like, whatever the conflict is in Genbu Kaiden.
Like, Genbu Kaiden's definitely more, like, international conflict.
Yeah, and, like, personal drama. But going off of Caitlin's point of it being, like, a very strong metaphor that in text gets very, like, you know, intense about it, is that there is a lot of dark stuff, particularly regarding sexual assault and things like that. Yeah, but they also, like, Miyaka's mom very explicitly at some point in a like flashback that Miyaka has is like, you know, Miyaka comes and is like, I'm so excited that Yui wants to apply to the same school as me. Like, that's cool. I want to go to the same school as Yui. And her mom is like, no, that's terrible. Now you just have one more person to compete with. And, like, she's smarter than you, so what if her getting in means that is the thing that, like, prevents you from getting in? And, like, it's war. Exams are war. And I was like, wow, okay, you just made it real clear here what's going on. I guess we all think that's part of what makes it compelling, is that it's, like, it takes those very real mundane dramas that we all, at least at one point, experienced and heightens them to international crisis, but also has, like, a really fair share of humor with Miyaka's, you know, eating lots of food and always being attracted to it, even though she's like, this is a bad situation, I shouldn't eat this steak, but I'm totally gonna, or whatever, and all those types of things. And it's just like, you know, are those extremes what make FY so compelling? Even though it's overwrought, is it, like, that's still what makes it compelling?
Yep.
Or... yeah, like, just generally more thoughts on, like, how explicit that metaphor is.
It gets explicit. I don't think it is yet. Like, that's only a vague spoiler. that, yes, it definitely does get more explicit, at least in the anime version.
Yeah.
But, like, you know, and I mean, at first, like, I used to be like, oh, you know, Miyaka and Yui are competing because girls are catty bitches. And it's just like, no, they're forced into competition just like they were in real life.
Yeah, and I feel like that's a common thing that happens to girls, right? Like, we feel like we're always competing over really silly garbage.
and I think that's definitely, like, something that was put in there intentionally, that to call it out, like, yes, like, they're being forced to compete. It's not a good thing. And it is something that happens to real people. Because there is a competitive edge to their friendship. They make bets about who's going to get a boyfriend first. Even though Yui is, like, you know, by all accounts, like, she is the smart one. She is the pretty one. She is the one who is expected to go places, which is, I think, part of what gives so much power to her fall, is that she just has, you know, it's like Taitsukun says, she had bad luck. That Miyaka didn't, because luck plays such a huge part in all of it, in how successful people are able to become.
For sure. I also want to add that the choices that they make, like, initially, there is definitely some luck / fortune randomness to it, but the choices that
she also makes bad choices
really define their trajectory ultimately. Like, she's put into a very bad situation, Yui. But she also goes along with the manipulation that she falls into. And we've already mentioned how Nakago is, like, a master manipulator. But we do also know she's smart. She's just not... She also expresses jealousy over Miyaka's, like, how everyone loves her. And how, even though she's a glutton, even though she's clumsy, she's still, like, the life of every group that she's in. And that she brings people together and she has this genuine warmth to her. And I'm pretty sure that that's part of the reason Yui loves her so much. But she's also envious of that, because she works so hard to be who she is, while Miyaka is also working hard. But, like, the things that people love about her are part of her, and she doesn't have to work for that. While the things that Yui is loved for, we find out more later, are based off her very, very hard dedicated work. And I think that that seed of envy, of Miyaka's like inherent lovableness, is probably what allows the manipulation to sink its claws into her so deeply. And like the whole love for Tamahome thing just makes it worse, because Tamahome falls in love with Miyaka, and that's exactly what Yui expects, right? Because she knows that Miyaka is so lovable.
Yeah.
So it just reinforces like the insecurity that she has about herself, and that conflict just like blows up.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, maybe on a level of like high school entrance exams, it's hard for us in America to like relate to that. But if we relate it to college entrance exams, it makes sense. Yeah. And like to Caitlin's point about like the luck aspect of it with Yui and Miyaka, it's like I've definitely heard stories like people, you know, there's certainly a contingent of people who are like, luck is BS. You know, there's no such thing as luck. You make your own luck, all those things. Mm-hmm. Which to an extent is true, fine, whatever. But like, I've definitely heard stories of, you know, the way, you know, if Miyaka was on the cusp of perhaps getting into the illustrious high school, like people have told me that if they have a bunch of people that they're like, I don't know how to determine this, they like throw the, you know, applications down the stairs, and whichever one lands on the first step or something, they'll be like, okay, that person is accepted. Like there is totally luck involved in these things that they're competing over.
Yeah, I question periodically why I am where I am. It's like, what about my application made them give me this position, right? Like, was I really that much more outstanding?
They threw your application down a stairs and you just landed on the first.
I mean, there is definitely an element of randomness to college applications. Like, there's just too many people who are like qualified to get into certain schools. You know, like, yeah, like there's so much luck.
So much luck.
I wouldn't call it all luck because sometimes it's actual like, oh, who do you know? Or who do your parents know? Or oh, your legacy or whatever. Like there's
it's not all hard work.
Maybe it's like I'm overly sensitive over the use of the word luck, but like there's definitely some
See, you're one of those people who doesn't like the word luck.
Well, it depends on what you use it to describe, right? Like good luck, bad luck, we use this term so much, but what do you mean by luck? Like, is it the randomness of the universe, or are you also talking about things like, oh, you were just born lucky into like a good family,
privilege,
stable home,
the privilege. No, I disassociate those things. Privilege is a different type of
so if we're dissociating these things, then there's also an aspect of that to this series and the story, because the families that Yui and Miyaka grow up in very much shape who they are, and we get more of that in part two, like in the second half. But we already see, you know, Miyaka's relationship with her mom, her divorced mom, is very important to her, and that's why she's trying to get into this really difficult to get into school, because her mom wants her there. So, you know, was that also luck that Miyaka was born to parents that ended up divorcing, and that her mom became so set on Miyaka getting into a good school so her reputation will be great? Like, is that part of the luck that shapes the story?
Well, now that's hard because we're not given enough insight into like what happened with her parents.
Yeah, but we do know the outcome. We know that the outcome was that mom became super focused on her daughter's success being a reflection of her. Like, there's a scene where Miyaka's mom, maybe it's the same scene, but like that Ashley mentioned before, but there's a scene where she's like, you must get into the school. But she like explicitly says, because you're getting into the school is going to be a reflection of my reputation or going to impact my reputation.
Right. And I think this is, you know, like I took a course on the Japanese education system a while back, and that was definitely a major, like, this is sort of something that is still true. But like, Kyoiku mamas, the education mothers who push their kids really, really hard to get into a good school to study, that and the entire, like, mom's entire life becomes about their kids getting into good schools. Because this is also, like, Fushigi Yugi came out in, like, the early 90s, shortly after the post-bubble, sort of, influenced that, like, Miyaka has to get into a good high school so that she can get into a good college and so that she can be successful. and her mom's like not going to accept anything less, because otherwise it doesn't look good out there for a young woman.
Yeah, and also from a divorced mom family. I think that's like a very subtle, maybe, but important part of Miyaka's identity, that and her mom's identity, that like they're from a broken quote unquote family.
I mean, yeah, I think what makes FY so compelling is that like it takes all these very, like, what I know of the Japanese school system is that, like, yeah, they study so hard for these high school exams and then have to do it, like, semi again for college. And I'm like, that seems way too intense, even if what I've heard is, like, by the time you get to college, then it's not as intense, which is, again, kind of the, like, opposite of America, maybe. And so I think, you know, FY is good at tapping into those emotions of, like, yes, we competed to get into schools, we competed to... for boys and all these things, and that's like life altering because like I certainly look back at things in high school now and I'm like, those things were not that important, but like in the moment they're super important, like it's your life, you're still living it. Mm-hmm. So like it captures those feelings really well,
right,
with like some divorcedness because Watase's slightly older but not quite fully divorced from that,
right? Like everything feels like the beginning, middle, and end of the world, and when Miyaka goes into the universe of the four gods, it really does become that important.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I totally relate to Miyaka's, like, even though, you know, the way some of those things are executed about sexuality and like about her school thing, like her mom is really harsh, I'm like, I can relate to these at least on some level, even if now I'm like, it's not that dire, you know, but like my parents definitely pushed me to go to a good school, even though they did not, like, precisely because they did not have the greatest educations themselves, and they're like, no, you do better, so like study a lot and blah blah blah. And even though now I'm like, you know, getting straight A's in school and whatever is like not really worth it, but like at the time I totally thought it was. And I'm like, oh no. I wish I had the opposite experience. Yeah, but whatever, it's relatable. Hashtag relatable. Yeah. Yeah, and then one of the last aspects that I wanted to talk about was how it's so relatable despite being, like, you know, it's part of this larger isekai genre, which is just, like, I think it just means, you know, people being sucked mm-hmm. into another world.
Yep.
Yeah, which I guess it's, like, you know, this... I think you wrote something on this, like, semi-recently, Caitlin, or...
A couple years ago.
Okay, a couple years ago. Same thing. I don't know. Time is an illusion.
Yeah, we're really than us. Listen, first experiencing this theory.
Yeah,
like I teach children who are younger than my blog.
Oh no!
My blog existed already when they were born.
So you're like, that's how it makes you feel old.
Time is messed up.
Yeah, time is messed up. That's basically the conclusion. But yeah, so I feel like there's been a resurgence of this genre kind of recently. This term was certainly not on my radar until more recently, but, like, I think there's, correct me if I'm wrong.
Recently, you mean 10 years ago. How long has Sword Art Online been around?
I was gonna say.
Not 10 years ago, but, like, definitely, like, 7.
Has it been that long?
Like, this can easily be looked up.
The anime was 2012, I believe.
Yeah. That's so funny. Yeah, 6 years ago. Yeah. Nailed it.
Nailed it.
2012. Got it. Thank you, Wikipedia.
Again, time is an illusion. But yeah, I just wanted to talk about how this relates to that genre as a whole, mm-hmm. how it's so relatable, even though it is people going into another world. I guess the one observation that I had written down was that, like, I feel like the recent things that are influenced by Sword Art Online and Sword Art Online itself are all about video games, mm-hmm. which are, like, kind of our real world escape. Like, we play video games, now we watch tons of anime about people playing video games and whatever. Great. There's, you know, lots of stuff going on there. But, like, so I feel like in the video game ones, you know, being in a different world is kind of almost purely a setting thing. Like, you're playing with other real people.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And there are only a certain amount of other NPCs that are around and are just programmed to do whatever. I don't think they're normally important. Whereas in Shigeyugi, you know, like, these are people who think they're like, I'm a real person, this is a real world. And then, like, Tamahome finds out from Yui that Yui's just like, you're just a character in some stupid book. And obviously they have a conception of what a book is. So Tamahome's like, I don't know what that means. And has a little bit of, like, existential angst about it for a while that gets a little dropped, but I'm sure we'll come up again.
It's a bit of a crisis.
Yeah, it's a bit of a crisis.
Midlife crisis.
So I think it's very interesting to see how, you know, introducing two new elements, being Miyaka and Yui, alters these people who otherwise think they're real people, but to Miyaka and Yui, they're just people in a book. And again, we've already mentioned, like, Miyaka's willing to go live in a book, apparently. Like, she gets totally sucked into it. She's like, I could do this. And I just think that's a very interesting contrast to what it has become now, where it's like, oh, well, like, video games apparently provide us all with some isekai actual things that are happening to us. Whereas it's much more interesting to see the drama of, like, no, Hotohori and Tamahome, like, totally think they're real people and, like, have their own lives and are controlled and, like, can understand the conception of, wait, I'm a character in a book. That's distressing. I don't like that.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Maybe I'm a bit whimsical in this, but I've always felt that they are real people. In the FY world, there is the real world of Miyaka and Yui, but the FY world itself, like the universe of the four gods, I feel like that is its own real world, and that the physical book that Miyaka and Yui travel through is a portal into another world, like actually an alternate universe, and that in their universe, it exists as a book, but the book is writing itself as things are experienced by the people in the other universe. So to me, Miyaka's not really like, okay, I'm going to live in a book. She's choosing to live in another universe and to abandon her own world.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that that means that she's choosing not to be a real person anymore, but that she feels that that world in that book is in itself a real, real existence. And that's why she can fall in love with a book character. Like, she has moments where she's like, oh, I'm being stupid. You're just a book character. I really cannot fall in love with you.
Yeah.
But that's, like, her trying to convince herself, and not very successfully, because she really ultimately, obviously, puts herself in and sees everyone around her as real people. And she cries real tears when random people that she doesn't even know in the real world, because they're in the book, die. Like, she doesn't see them as just characters. And she won't see her own existence continuing in that universe as just, you know, a character.
Right. I guess the other thing that's interesting to contrast it with, you know, video game, more recent popular isekai things is that, like, you know, they do go into the book. The book has very, like, you would think going into a book is kind of silly and whimsical, inconsequential, but, like, the things that Yui and Miyaka experience going into the book are, like, they had to grow up much faster than they would have if they just took their damn high school entrance exams and whatever. Like, they're experiencing real trauma to their bodies and stuff like that. Whereas I feel like, you know, part of the appeal of going into a video game is like, oh, it doesn't matter if I die here. Obviously, the first arc of Sword Art Online is kind of like, no, the point is that, like, they get sucked into it and then it's not fun because the threat is that if they do die in the game, that they'll die in real life or whatever. But, like,
they can't log out. That button was removed.
Yeah. So, like, there's that threat. But, like, just in general, you know, you would think the construction of a story that's like, I went into a book, it would just be like silly things happen in the book. But obviously, it makes it actually much more heightened drama than going into the book. So, that's like an interesting inversion, I guess.
So, the thing is that, like, isekai is absolutely booming in anime and light novels right now. And a lot of that is, it originated with Sword Art Online, but I think a lot of that is the fact that a lot of what's being published right now is actually originating from web novels, which is just people self-publishing their books online. And then if they're really popular, they could get picked up by publishers to be printed. They can get adapted into anime, like Death March to the Parallel World Rhapsody was one of those last year or last season, unfortunately. So they are like, we are not getting, there are ones that have main female characters, but we're not getting them. Those are not getting adapted into anime right now. They're not really getting translated, like published in English right now, which is unfortunate. But, like, so since they are, like, self-published web novels, they tend to be more escapist power fantasies. Like Sword Art Online is sort of following the otakuization of the anime market, which the industry, I think, is sort of starting to come back from there. But for a while, it was pretty much all like moe stuff aimed, made by people, by the guys who had grown up watching anime about like what they wanted to see. So like Sword Art Online was sort of on the tail end of when that was really the big thing, I think. So like there's a lot of factors coming in here where it's like isekai anime these days are like just, you know, they're mainly male driven power fantasies. And like, you know, there are exceptions to that. But like if you watch like some of the ones that have been made recently, like, you know, like I said, Death March, the Parallel World, like In Another World with My Smartphone, the main characters are like so like overpowered from the absolute very beginning. Like they have no struggles, they have no fights. They come in and they like get these girls who are like all over them. In Death March, they're his slaves. Like they're literally slaves. No. So it's like, for me, that's sort of the main dividing line between like the 90s shoujo isekai, like Fushigi Yugi, like Magic Knight Rayearth, like 12 Kingdoms. The main difference is like those were like very much like adolescent coming of age through a filter of fantasy, whereas these are like grown men writing about the lives that they wished they had.
Yeah. I guess that explains the difference of why, you know, FY's overwrought, troubling things are still compelling and they can be upsetting, but like I still really like it. Whereas Sword Art Online, I was like, I hate you. I'm dropping you so fast. I can't take your garbage anymore. Because I just feel like the escapist fantasy that Sword Art Online is putting on is very much like in contrast to what Jessica was saying of like all these, the bad Sayuri warriors have motivations and all those things. Like I felt like every villain in Sword Art Online is just evil for the sake of being evil, and they like disrespect women and like whatever, that's their whole deal. And I'm like, ugh.
why did you murder all of these people?
Yeah, I always appreciate it more when the fantasy world is thought of as like a real world. Mm-hmm. And when the characters feel invested in that alternative world and the people in it and can make lasting, meaningful connections to those people, even if they are from two separate worlds. And I think that's where Sword Art lost me, because Kirito is always trying to be like, oh, what happens in like this alternate universe of the game is real, but I don't feel it as much. Maybe because he can have those relationships in the real world too with the real people, while Miyaka has no way to connect with anyone from the universe of the Four Gods except through the book.
Yeah. Also, Miyaka burning her ribbon was stupid. Can we just throw that out there?
Oh my god. I mean, Miyaka makes some bad calls.
She's 15. Almost 16. But
she's 15. She's not very smart.
No. Yeah, Miyaka is definitely very compulsive and easily led by her emotions. And she needs time and oftentimes other people to remind her of her responsibility. And I think that's like a reflection of her age, and that's one of her flaws that I can appreciate. I get annoyed with her, but at the same time, I understand that she's a 15-year-old girl who is dealing with life and death and responsibility for a whole country that she clearly doesn't consider fictional or in a book. Like, she's very in deep, and she feels responsible for all those people, and she constantly thinks of like Kamahome and is selfish in certain regards. But at the same time, with some reminders, she also thinks of like the whole country that she's supposed to be protecting and the war that she's trying to prevent from happening.
Yeah. I just wish Toski had also been like, hey, Miyaka, maybe we should think about this for a second.
Oh, please. Like you said, part of the reason you love him so much is he's not the person who would do that.
He's not the thinker. He's just the doer. He just does.
He's too straightforward and blunt. You tell him to do something, especially that involves fire, and he will do it.
He's a really good boy, though.
He's a good boy. Yeah. He just did what Miyaka wanted.
Yeah, and no one understood. But also, he could have questioned it a little bit. She's seemingly talking to herself in very angry tone. Yeah. So no one knew what was going on.
Oh yeah, that was pretty funny. Yeah. Wanted to move on to discussing art And CC Takato on Twitter had asked me if I thought that FY should have a, like, rebooted anime. And part of me was like, no. I did say no. But then I forgot that Watase had actually done drawings a few years ago, redoing the original FY characters as if they were going to make a new anime. And I wondered if we had any thoughts about their redesigns or, you know, answer the question of whether you think there should be a rebooted FY anime.
I mean, I think what I said earlier kind of tells you that I'm not a huge fan of
the I know you hate these new designs, probably.
I mean,
I think they're cool. Oh, you're wrong.
I love the complicated 90s style that you have. Like, her art evolution became simpler and, like, cleaner. But I miss the old style so much. So I would be okay with not a remake.
I wouldn't want her to necessarily remake the manga. I think the anime had... there were some episodes where there were some very poor animation decisions and just some moments of just really, like, hilariously off-model animation. I would love to see a redone anime, and I would love to see it sort of not just, like, redo the animation, remake the animation, but also to improve on some of the plot holes to make it less shitty about some things.
But would you change the art? I mean, would you change the style? Like, you're talking about, I think, different things. Like, changing plot and filling in those awful holes versus updating
both.
The style of the drawing, not like the flawed animation. I remember those moments too, like, oh my gosh, what is happening on the screen? But ignoring those, like, I'm very happy with the way it was animated in terms of the art.
Yeah, like, I think I like the art style. I don't, but, like, the art style doesn't look exactly like Watase's art anyway. Like, I think that's a sort of separate discussion from what from the manga art. Like, I like the manga art. It has some off model moments.
So they're much less pretty in the anime. Everyone.
But, like, I think, like, somewhat updated, but also still giving it that, like, kind of 90, having that kind of 90s feel, I think probably would be good. But yeah, like, I mean, I do love, like, the anime art. Yeah, no, I think that's what I'm going to go with, like, keeping that sort of 90s look and feel, but updating it somewhat. I don't know. I'm not an art person.
I mean, I'm enough of an art person that I didn't get through Genbu Kaiden, but I will try to change that. I will try to change.
You're just wrong, though.
I would love to see a Blu-ray remastering of the original anime.
Yeah, because, I think, like, the original anime is fine. Like, I would rather have a Genbu Kaiden anime, personally.
Well, I also just, I love, 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 love remastered, high definition, Blu-ray quality cell animation. Like, new animation, like, the new computer, like, animation, like, it's fine. I'm not like, cel shaded is better inherently, all this digital animation is crap. Yeah. Like, I'm not, you know, that's not who I am. But, like, if you look at the Blu-ray, like, have you seen, like, the Blu-ray remastering of, like, G Gundam?
I have not.
Like, I didn't watch G Gundam. Jared's really into G Gundam, and he showed me, like, the opening, the remastered opening, and it was stunning. Like, I will always choose, like, I do have a preference for cel animation. Like, I don't think digital animation is all automatically garbage, and I think it has made a lot of things possible. But, like, just the lines and the colors and the vibrancy of cel animation, like, there's so, like, on that Blu-ray remaster is just, like, oh, it's stunning. And I would love to see that treatment for Fushigi Yugi, warts and all. But I don't think that's going to happen.
Yeah.
Even if it did, it probably wouldn't come out in the U.S. Just the opening. Yes. Can you imagine the opening in, like, high definition? Oh,
be so good. It's not going to happen, though, so that's very sad.
I'm looking at the pictures that were posted in 2016. I'm like, they don't look as pretty to me. Like, Tamahome's face? No, his face?
Yes, they do, Jessica. Okay, Tamahome looks more like in a rookie clone in that.
Well, I don't like
the main character of Genbu.
So
Tamahome is the one where I'm like, okay, I don't care about. No. I admit that Tamahome is like a downgrade, but I think everybody else is good.
Noriko is not as attractive to me.
Jessica, you're stuck in the 90s. You know?
Mitsukake has been slimmed down too much, honestly. Like I'm not like hot for his original look, but I don't want him to be like turned into like yet another slender Bishonen. I liked that he had a slightly different look. I like Hotohori and Toski.
Yeah, I agree with
lot.
That. I agree with that.
But yeah, like, I like Toski a lot.
Pretty anymore. Oh, I'm shallow. I want my favorite character to be beautiful. Okay, like if you scroll down a little on that page from geek.com and you see the colored drawings from the original. Oh my god, they're so beautiful. Like. No, don't change that. That's like
they are beautiful
because you're not like they're not as they're just not pretty anymore. I mean, I remember liking the characters themselves, but being thrown off by the art. So I will try it again. Although I really like the whole best friends turned enemy, but not really hating each other thing. Like still loving each other under all the angst and all the supposed betrayal. Should we move on?
Shipping corner. Answer the question from Hoodley on Twitter. Who do you think is the best couple in the series?
Miyaka and Tamahome.
Caitlin, you think Miyaka and Tamahome?
Yeah.
That's a... Well, we don't have to, like, discuss this whole list, but just, like, you don't have an off-the-top answer, Jessica?
Yeah. Can I have Yui and Miyaka as a couple? And Noriko and Tamahome as a couple?
I mean, you could.
Not as, like, a romantic... couple, but like,
no. This is romantic time.
fine, romantic time. Then I would have to be Tamahome. Like,
yeah,
I don't see romance between any of the other pairings that are listed. I know the Hotohori and Noriko pairing. I wish I were on board with that, but I don't know. I have to revisit the second half of the series before I answer that.
That's true. We do need to get to the second half of the series.
Yeah.
But
I
feel
the
like...
the Hotohori-Noriko couple, mm-hmm. I have to hold off.
I think... Yeah, and I went into why I like Miyaka and Tamahome. I think... Like, listen, I don't think they're an out-and-out good couple. It's like, listen, once all this is done, what are they going to have to talk about, right? Like...
I don't know.
I mean, I don't know what Miyaka sees in him, because all she ever really discussed was how hot he was.
But he's
but I feel like
he's
he
nice
actually
too.
Loves her.
He's really good to her.
Yeah, I know, but like I don't understand what she loves about him specifically. I can see what's lovable about him.
I enjoy that you both name them as your favorite couple and then are like, wait, but I don't like totally
well,
think
there's
great.
No
why isn't Toski and Chichiri on this list?
Well,
Toski and Chichiri is what
taken.
I'm gonna say.
No, but Chichiri is kind of taken. Like he's still
hung up
on his
whatever. Toski and Chichiri all the way, y'all.
Wait, as in those two together?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, that's it.
Yeah.
Okay, that's different.
No, I ship them. They're a great team. I think they love each other. Those are my true feelings. Mm-hmm. I mean, Tamahome and Miyaka is great. Again, I just feel like I'm not, like, actually invested in the relationship at all.
Yeah. Again, I'm just stuck on, like, why does Miyaka love him? Like, I can see why people can love him, but she doesn't express it well. Like, all we know is that she does love him, and to me, like, her initial attraction was just that attraction. And then, like, yes, he loves his family. Yes, he's loyal. Yes, he treats her very well once he falls in love back. But why was she so convinced she loved him in the first place? Was it just
she's
like, 15. Oh, he saved my life and he's gorgeous?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because that's what I get. And I'm like,
I mean, that's as good a reason as any, like, to start a relationship. And it's like, listen, she says she loves him at first, but it is infatuation and obsession. Yeah. And, like, I don't buy that she loves him at first, but I do think that they fall in love. You know, I do think that, like, she does, like, come to see more about him than
his looks.
Than his looks.
And his martial arts,
Yeah.
I love when he attacked Nakugo towards the end of these volumes, and he's like, was that my power? Wait, no, I have to go find Miyaka. I have a thing to do. I can't dwell on how I just shot a ball of energy from my hands. Like, cool.
I really like him as a character, actually.
Yeah.
Like, I really do. I just wish I believed Miyaka's love for him, because I think he is so lovable, and I'm just like, I really hope she does love him for the right reasons.
Oh. Just assume she does.
Yeah, I guess I shall. I mean, I guess I do, because I do ship them as well.
Great. We can revisit Shipping Corner, obviously, in the next second half.
Mm-hmm.
For now, are there any other final thoughts that do not spoil the second half?
I guess I'm happy that I still feel so much.
Yeah, you're happy that you cried for three straight volumes? Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Well... Yeah, crying sucks. It hurts my eyes and nose, and then makes me feel like crap. But I'm glad that even without, I think, like, even without the nostalgia goggles, that I still love this series so much. I forgot how much I loved it, and now it's like, oh, now I'm gonna go watch the opening.
Great, I love reminding you.
Yeah, I'm gonna go watch the opening as soon as we're finished, because, oh, epicness.
Thanks for listening to Shoujo and Tell. Comments, questions, constructive criticism, concerns, need to gush about your OTP? Email shoujoandtell@gmail.com or leave a comment on shoujoandtell.com/fushigiyuji1. We're at shoujoandtell on lots of social media things like Twitter, Facebook, Tumblr, and Instagram. Caitlin, where can people find your work on the internet?
So many places.
I know.
Listen, I've been a busy bee. All right. there's heroinproblem.com, heroin with an E, is my personal website. I've mostly been writing about shoujo manga, and specifically talking about how abusive relationships are represented into it for the last few weeks, which might be relevant to the interests of some of the listeners here.
Yeah.
I'm also an editor and contributor for animefeminist.com. We just wrapped, well, I don't know if this will be the case when this episode goes live, but as of recording, we just wrapped up our spring season coverage, and I have started contributing regularly to the Daily Dot with their anime coverage. So yeah,
Caitlin writes a lot about the animes and the shoujos and the stuff.
I do. It's basically a second job at this point.
And then Jessica is the opposite. You cannot find Jessica on the internet. She does not.
I do not
partake
have,
in these
Instagram,
social medias.
Tumblr, Facebook.
You're like, what the heck's an Instagram? Yeah.
Yeah. It's someone with a little ghost thing, right?
No.
Oh shoot.
Is that a joke?
No. Wait. What?
That's Snapchat. Okay. Oh, see, we just proved that Jessica is very bad at this. Okay.
You can edit that out.
No, I love it. It's great. It proves everything. Anyway, are you excited every time you see a new episode from us? If so, please consider leaving a rating in iTunes or Stitcher. This will help the podcast reach more hearts, or at least ears. Thanks again for listening. We'll be back next time for the second half of Fushigi Yugi, where everything gets real sad and tragic even more than it already was. I don't know. That'll be fun. Stay tuned. Until then, bye.
Bye.
Bye.